Welcome to the Second Reading Podcast from the University of Texas at Austin.
The Republicans were in the Democratic Party because there was only one party.
So I tell people on a regular basis, there is still a land of opportunity in America. It's called Texas.
The problem is these departures from the Constitution, they have become the norm.
At what point must a female senator raise her hand or her voice to be recognized over the male colleagues in the room?
And welcome back to the Second Reading Podcast. I'm Jim Henson, director of the Texas Politics Project at the University of Texas at Austin. Happy to be joined today by Josh Blank, research director for the Texas Politics Project. Good morning, Josh.
Good morning to you.
So, you know, we are continuing on with some of the postmortem, I suppose, from the 2024 election here. Lots of questions that have arisen, even as at the same time, you know, we're given our focus, we're inevitably kind of pivoting towards the coming legislative session and what's going to be happening next year in Texas politics. But today, we're going to focus on the discussion of shifts in the Latino voting patterns, which, of course, have been a major topic of the debrief and the follow-up on the 2024 election. Mm-hmm. Following, of course, on a lot of speculation going into the election about increases in Republican gains among Latinos, and now that the voting's finally happened, whether and how much movement there was, how durable is that movement, how might we understand it?
Right.
You know, Texas has been at the center of this discussion, so mm-hmm. Today, we have dug into the extensive data that we have in our polling data archive, as well as some of the election results, to try to get our heads around what happened in Texas in the election. And, you know, maybe more subtly and maybe more important, you know, how long has this been happening? I think we'll, once we go through some of the data, I think one of the, you know, spoiler alert, you know, there's a question that, you know, I think we've been kicking around, a lot of people have, which is, you know, how clear were the leading indicators? Should we have seen this coming?
Should somebody have seen it coming,
you know,
somewhere?
And look, to be fair, I don't want to, you know, put us in a vacuum here. I mean, a lot of Republicans have been talking about the fact that they've been working and this should be expected. But, you know, that talk has been going on for a while with only, you know, minimal evidence of progress. So we thought we'd dig into, you know, what we could pull out of this in public opinion data and look at the election results.
Well, and also, I think just to be fair, in all of this is, you know, we need the elections as sort of, you know, key indicators here. And so part of this is that I would say, you know, Republican efforts have definitely increased over time in ways that we'll probably talk about a little bit more at the end. But, you know, the data available that indicates, you know, sort of their gains has been a little bit thin up until this point. Now,
right.
I think when we look at our data, you'll sort of see where it is, but it's not the sort of stuff that you would go and say from one poll to the next, like, oh my God, you know, Republican identification among Latinos is up 2 points since June. Yeah. Like, we wouldn't do that as anyone who here listens, because we don't know if that's the case yet. But the elections are kind of where the rubber meets the road. And in this election in particular, the rubber has met the road, and now we need to kind of go back and understand it a little bit better, I think.
Yeah, and, you know, we kind of go by the basic, you know, statistical baseline is you need three to at least begin talking about a trend.
Right.
And a lot of the movement that we've seen most recently was in 2020, and that did set the expectation for this election. So mm-hmm. Let's start by stepping back a bit and looking at the trend, some of the trend data leading up to the election. And I think, you know, the way we've kind of laid this out is, you know, one of the big macro questions looming here is, you know, what do we know and how should we think about Latino political identification?
Right.
I mean, the exit polls in Texas suggest that Trump won about 55% of the Latino vote in the state and that he won about 45% of the vote nationally, which was not a plurality, but was a 13-point increase from the Latino share that Trump had gotten just 4 years before, again, national exit polls in 2020. And at that point, that was, you know, and I think this time what we've seen is a record high for a Republican presidential nominee. So, you know, I think if we, you know, Josh, you did a lot of good prep on this that's super helpful. I mean, if we disaggregate our own time series data on the polling side, it does tell us some interesting things about partisanship. And, you know, I guess another spoiler alert, it kind of suggests that maybe we shouldn't be so surprised by Trump's success in Texas in 2024. This is something that's been brewing a while, and we've been talking about it over the last few years. So, you know, tell us a little bit about what you found as you compile all that data.
Yeah, and I mean, we could have gone back, you know, further into the archives, but just for tractability here, you know, we just decided to look at 2016, or I decided, I should say, you could say go back and look at it again, but I decided to look at 2016 to 2024, and partially just thinking about the impact of Trump on the parties, and sort of keep this a little bit tighter. So between 2016 and in the middle of 2019, no fewer than 50% of Hispanic registered voters identified as Democrats. Well, no more than 39% identified as Republicans. So the way that I think about this was sort of the two-third, one-third kind of territory. About two-thirds, give or take, of Hispanic registered voters were identified as Democrats, about one-third as Republicans. Again, I was giving you sort of the maximums and the minimums there. But when you look at the data on the whole, that's about what it looked like. Since 2020, though, the share of Hispanics identifying as Democrats hasn't broken 53%. So if you think about before, we said it was at least 50%. Well, now I'm saying since 2020, it hasn't gone above 53%. So it's been very constrained in terms of Democratic identification. So I think first and foremost, just to put that out as a baseline here in Texas, it's not as though, you know, even going into the election, anyone should have expected Hispanics to necessarily be like a 70-30 group, maybe not even a 60-40 Democratic group. This is a competitive group. Now, since 2020, again, the share of Hispanics identifying as Republicans has varied between a low of 29% and a high of 51%, which was the recording we got in October, so our last poll of the year before the election. But at least in the last year alone, has ranged between 35 and 45%. So I think that's a little bit more of an accurate kind of
Well,
picture.
And it, you know, what's one of the things that's interesting about that, you know, as I was looking at this and the data you compiled is, you know, how closely that matches what seems to have been the operational conventional wisdom, right? And conventional wisdom, I should even say that, you know, the basic operational assumptions in campaigns, which is, you know, Republicans needed to be around 40%.
Yeah.
You know, you know, in an election where it would seem like they weren't doing well among Hispanics, you know, if you go back further, they were a little under that in the 35-39 range. In the elections where they really, you know, kind of kicked ass and ran it up, you know, they got as high as the mid, you know, low, you know, 44%.
I think 44 is the number.
Was the Abbott number.
That's right. The Abbott Wendy Davis number. That's what I was thinking. And at that time, people were like, oh my God, what is this? You know, but if you look at this data, you say, look, you know, just in party ID alone, again, you're looking at, you know, a party that probably is about, you know, 40, 45%, you know, on sort of a baseline party ID. So, you know, in some of this, and just looking at sort of party identification, you know, identification with the GOP was, you know, high in this election historically. So let's say that. But it hasn't really grown dramatically outside of that over time. And I would say really what it is the floor of Republican identification among Hispanics is definitely higher than it was. But I think perhaps maybe hidden in some of this fluctuation, you know, is this trend towards, again, just higher baseline Republican, you know, identification. Again, there's variation from one poll to the next. We'll kind of get to that a little bit in the end, and it sort of leads to sort of, I think, why people either overinterpret or hold back on interpretation. But what we can say is that, you know, they're just looking at our polling. There are more Republican identifying Hispanics now than there were 8 years ago. I think that's very, very clear in the data. But I think even more notable in some ways is the decline in Democratic identification. Which, although again, still somewhat constrained, it's a little bit because they're competitive, right? So it's going to be constrained, but it's more noticeable in the data. So I was saying, you know, before, I think the fluctuation is what's kind of made this movement hard to peg down in real time, honestly, because overall, first of all, most people are not conducting polls every 2 months like we are, number one. Number two, Hispanics tend to make up a smaller share of the, I mean, they're a share of the sample of, you know, voters overall. So nationally, they tend to be, you know, again, they're going to be a small-ish share of the overall sample. If you have a 1,000-person sample, maybe it's 250, maybe it's 300 people. That's not nobody, but you wouldn't necessarily want to make a big deal out of a jump in party identification in one of, you know, three polls you might conduct this year.
Right. I mean, you're going to see pretty regularly, and I'm not looking at the data very closely right now, but it seems to me, you know, the amplitude of that, you're looking, you know, if something jumps up about 5 points, you're going to notice it, but you're not going to you know, go to the bank on it.
No, and you can't, because honestly, and we've talked about it all the time, you know, almost in all cases, it's within the margin of error for that subsample, because the lump number is low. So anybody who does run out and say, oh my God, you know, we see a 5-point increase in Trump support among Hispanics, like, well, that's, you know, that could be a change. It could be just variation. But I think overall what this does is it does raise, you know, some tougher questions in Texas here about the strength or weakness of Democratic Party attachment among these voters, right? I think questions about sort of their previous and ongoing efforts with these groups. But I think more generally, this is sort of maybe the bigger picture question about the strength of partisan attachment among Hispanics overall, especially given that this group is going to be highly contested in every election cycle going forward here.
Right. I mean, you know, in Texas, I mean, I like the way you laid that out, because you know, we're trying to understand a couple of different things at once.
Right.
There's the methodological underpinnings, right? But then there's, on one hand, this group that I think, at least at this moment, in the period we're looking at, as you say, I think it's a good way, you know, has weaker party attachments.
I think that's right.
Right? I mean, especially compared to African-American, you know, black voters.
Absolutely. And I think you might even say compared to white voters.
Well, and that was going to be my next question. I mean, I think that's an interesting follow-up, I think.
Yeah, not ready for that one today, but.
But also, on the other hand, and this is another thing that's kind of part of the big macro discussion right now, but is really acute in Texas, is, you know, the mismatch in resources, the degree to which the Democratic Party in Texas is just has not been well positioned to contest this group.
Yeah.
As people have observed frequently. Mm-hmm. But also, you know, in other words, the variable of Democratic organizational party weakness is, you know, we've harped on it. I especially have harped on it before and here. But I think this really raises that yet again in another guise.
Yeah, I think we'll come back to that a little bit at the end.
I think so. Parse out
some of the bigger movements here.
Okay, so as we think about what this might mean in the longer term, you know, and you kind of hinted at this when you sort of talked about picking 2016 as the starting point, we have to consider the Trump factor.
Right.
And so, you know, what did you find, you know, what do we have to talk about in terms of Latinos' views of Donald Trump?
Well, in the October poll, you know, favorability ratings toward Donald Trump among Hispanics were split, 48 favorable, 48 unfavorable, with pretty similar levels of intensity. So 37% of Hispanics had a very favorable view of Trump, 42% of Hispanics had a very unfavorable view of Trump. You know, unsurprisingly, you know, Trump performs best with, you know, Hispanic Republicans. And they, you know, again, that's not nobody. I mean, that's we already talked about it.
Right.
It's a growing.
As we just said.
I mean, it's almost like, as I say it out loud, I almost want to stop myself and say, and this is an important point, not a small share of Hispanics. This is the first to fall on the first point, right? So among Hispanic Republicans, 83% have a favorable view of him. Among Hispanic conservatives, 72% hold a favorable view towards Trump. But I should say there's a lot of variance among other key groups for Republicans within the Latino community. So when we look at rural Hispanics, and I should say, because of what I just said, you're going to say, if anyone is listening to this carefully, they should say, well, wait a minute, doctor. You just said you've only got 300 Hispanics. How many rural Hispanics, you know, do you even have? And I would say that is a good point. But that's why what I'm doing here is, for the most part, I'm going to report the October poll results. But I've also looked at the trends.
Right.
These are pretty consistent over time in the 6 polls we're doing, you know, every year, or they've, you know, so it's like, I feel confident that these results are pretty steady, you know, in terms of what we've seen, at least. So just to say that out loud. Okay, so going back again. So there's a lot of variance among other key groups within the sort of Republican Latino sort of universe, right? Rural Hispanics, 57 favorable towards Trump, but 43 unfavorable. Pretty interesting, right? I mean, rural Hispanics. Among male Hispanics, 55 favorable, 42 unfavorable. College-educated Hispanics, 53-39. Hispanics making over $60,000 a year in family income, 49-46. What's interesting is the other side, and this will kind of get into this a little bit, where he's underwater, and I won't go through every one of the numbers because they're pretty close. It's basically about 45-50, and, you know, 40-50,
right.
45-50, favorable, unfavorable. And for those groups, it's Hispanics who make under $60,000 a year, Hispanics under 44 years old, Hispanics without a college degree, suburban Hispanics, female Hispanics. And what's interesting to me about that, and we'll kind of maybe come back to this, is in some ways, you know, and this was surprising to me, honestly, because I think, you know, a lot of the discussion after the election was about this notion that, well, Trump was appealing to blue-collar workers of all races and ethnicities. But when you look at actually this data and you break down Hispanics by these different categories, you actually see a group that almost looks, you know, the group in terms of who is most supportive of Trump and Republicans in this case, look a little bit more traditionally Republican. And I, what I mean is, you know, before, yeah, right. you know, in the sense of, you know, a little bit more affluent, college educated, higher income.
Rural and male.
Male. Yeah.
yeah.
Conservative. You know, also,
right.
I mean, you know, so in some ways it looks like, you know, and in some ways I think this actually sort of speaks to some of the story and texts we'll come back to, but in the fact that Republicans have been really successful in a lot of ways at identifying Hispanic voters, but I think also really successful at identifying, we said this before, Hispanic voters with largely Republican profiles otherwise. Right.
Although what I would add to that is that, you know, these splits, you know, in...
There's a couple of good points here.
In the groups that are, you know, less, you know, that are still net negative on Trump, you
yeah.
know, the ones you just mentioned,
right.
under 60,000. In other words, what looked like we would have thought of 10 years ago as a more traditional Democratic subgroup.
Right.
Right. But it also speaks to, you know, the subtlety that I think we talked about in terms of the vote targeting going into the election a bit. You know, if these are all net negative in terms of Trump, but narrowly so, to go back
right.
to our point about the subgroups, right? So if, you know, if you're a Republican candidate, if you're Donald Trump, and you're pretty close to splitting all of these groups of Hispanics while you are, you know, clearly doing well with the more, you know, Republican-inclined subgroups.
Right.
You know, you're doing pretty well.
Yeah.
And it would be interesting to go back probably and look at these, say, in maybe the second Obama election, right?
Yeah.
Because my guess is in 2012, these, you know, 45-50 splits weren't as close.
Yeah, I think that's probably right.
Right. And so, you know, you're getting something done here.
Well,
if you're Trump.
Yeah, right? Well, I mean, what it seems to
Or even compare him to an Abbott election.
But, I mean, even fitting this back into the discussion we had about party ID here, I mean, I think what you see here is exactly this in some ways, which is, you know, you are seeing Trump improve among these constituencies, but among constituencies that we kind of think of as, you know, again, setting aside their ethnic minority status, you'd say these are kind of Republican-leaning constituencies. And what you're seeing is less strength in the Democratic-leaning constituencies
right.
in the set of attitudes that Democrats would need to mobilize to be more competitive here. And also, it's not surprising to see all these splits relatively close because, again, overall, it was 48-48.
Right.
So we're not going to have some, you know, groups, you know, wildly off in either direction unless they're, you know, again, very unlikely.
Yeah, some very infinitesimally small...
Yeah, there could,
you know,
yeah, we don't need to go
three
into
times reduced subgroup, right?
Yeah. Yeah, or, well, I mean, I would say, or if there was some insane polarization between like men and women or between
right,
or
right,
something
yeah.
generational stuff, which we looked at, but it's a little complicated for this discussion right now.
And, you know, and look, the difference between men and women in this is one of the bigger ones.
It is one of the bigger ones.
Right, because, you know, the one exception in that, all of those that were like 45-50, mm-hmm. slightly net negative for Trump, among women, he's 40-52.
Right.
That's like, to me, that's the only one that is clearly, you know, kind of reliably negative on, you know, relative to the other groups.
Yeah. And
net negative. I mean, a net negative of 12, I'm willing to say, means something.
Well, and it's interesting, actually, because it is so clearly mirrored. I mean, there's a whole other discussion about,
right.
you know, the partisan
gender
gap. Where
the men are 55-42.
But what's right. interesting about that is actually how symmetrical that gap is, because
mm-hmm.
that's actually a little unusual, right? I mean, from
yeah.
what we normally see. So anyway.
And I don't think the national numbers look this way. I don't have them in front of me.
Yeah, I don't think so either.
I don't think they were quite, you know, the gender gap was quite as large. Gender
well,
gap, so to say.
Right. So overall, you know, just looking at the trends, you know, Trump generally has net negative favorability ratings among Hispanics here in Texas, but there's been a significant improvement over time. You know, I think to summarize it briefly, when he first entered office, they were very negative. They got less negative while he was in office. They increased during the pandemic, decreased, and then have basically kind of settled into, you know, again, net negative, but in a manageable territory,
right.
I would say, you know, which is to say, you know, in this election, again.
Particularly once he was out of office.
Yeah, well, particularly once he was out of office. But, you know, there was a point in time in which, you know, when he entered office, he was at negative net 50 net favorability. And, you know, in the last year, he's ranged between, you know, negative 16 and 5 plus
now see
five.
That now that sets us up perfectly for the next thing, because, you know, the conventional and, you know, well, the default, put it this way, I shouldn't say conventional, the default explanation for those early period high net negatives among Latinos was the campaign rhetoric and policy positions on immigration and the border. Right. Signature issue for Trump and Republican campaigns. You know, and in that early period, it was pretty, I mean, I think everybody kind of expected that Trump's rhetoric and then later his record once he got in office would, you know, at best prove unattractive to Latinos, at worst would fundamentally alienate them. And as you say, that seemed to be operative for a while, but it's been evident for, you know, a while now, a couple of years, and I think you found this in the data, that a lot of the assumptions or assertions about Latino attitudes on immigration and the border were wrong. That is, you know, he doesn't seem to have completely poisoned the well with Latinos, and the more recent data really underlines this.
Yeah, I mean, if you know, thinking about sort of the signature issue, sort of mass deportations in this election, you know, if we look at a question we've asked many, many times, you know, over the years, our polling finds approximately 45% of Hispanic voters in Texas who agree with the concept of immediate deportation of all undocumented immigrants currently living in the United States, and again, immediately. So the underlying sort of concept is basically, you know, essentially a coin flip among Hispanic registered voters here. We asked, you know, three times in the last year whether or not the U.S. allows too many, too few, or the right amount of legal immigrants. So we're talking about legal immigration now into the U.S. 49, 50, and 49% of Hispanics said too many in February, June, and October of this year. So again, about half. And, you know, look, while 68% of Hispanics said that immigrants are generally hardworking people, 63% said that they fill jobs Americans won't do, 62% said they are part of what makes America special, 50% said they put a strain on local resources, 43% said that they are looking for handouts and welfare, 36% say they are more likely to commit crimes, and 31% say they take jobs and wages away from U.S. citizens. So, you know, while there's been a lot of this discussion around some Trump's more extreme immigration policies or policy ideas, and they seem to explicitly or implicitly link these policy discussions about sort of the salience of the experience of racism to Latinos, it's not clear that the policies themselves are actually being received negatively on their own terms even, right?
Right.
And then this sort of gets to this kind of more complicated discussion of, you know, sort of Hispanic views of racism and where they even sort of intersect immigration attitudes. This is a huge discussion. We're just because we have so much data, we're going to do this briefly, just going to talk about this. But in June 2024...
Introduce the battery.
I'm going to do that. So in June of 2024, we asked about views of discrimination in America, and particularly how much discrimination multiple different groups face, and then which groups face the most discrimination. So if we look at Hispanic responses, 23% of Hispanics said Hispanics face a lot of discrimination in America today, which is close to the 21% who said the same about Christians. Now, this is something we pointed out a lot. When we ask Republicans about the groups that face the most discrimination, often they will say Christians, white people, and men are usually pretty high up there. If there's not another group that's actually facing significant discrimination in the press, then they usually hit the third spot. But among conservative Hispanics, so Hispanics who identify as conservative, 40% say Christians face a lot of discrimination, 24% say the same of men, 21% say the same of white people, 18% say the same of black people, but only 15% say the same of Hispanics, right? So I think without getting too detailed on this piece of this, I think what we should say is that our people's assumptions about Hispanic views about race and racism and sort of their, you know, place in the race.
Yeah, their social, yeah, their social hierarchy, experience, you know, in the racial hierarchy. We can say that.
Yeah. Okay. Can we? Okay.
You know, I can say that.
You can say it. So, you know, I'll just one more piece of data. You know, in April of 2022, we did a survey experiment in which we asked half of our sample whether or not Texas should accept refugees from Ukraine, and the other half if Texas should accept refugees from Central and South America. Not surprisingly, more Texans were willing to accept Ukrainian than Central and South American refugees. It was 60% versus 46%. Among Hispanics, it was 58% to 46%. Among Hispanic men, it was 67% for Ukrainian refugees, 40% for Central and South American refugees. Among Hispanic conservatives, 41% for Ukrainian refugees, 21% for Central and South American refugees. I think this should hopefully burst any bubbles that anyone has about simple interpretations of Hispanic views about towards both immigration and immigration policy, but also how we think about the role that sort of concepts of race, racism, and racial hierarchy might play into those attitudes.
You know, note while we're recording, you know, we got to rerun this.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah, sure.
I mean, I think I, you know, it would be, you know, not only for the Hispanic piece and the Latin American immigration piece, but also on the Ukrainian piece of this.
Yeah, sure.
Because when was this?
22.
Yeah, so this was still, you know, this was pretty early and
this was
right after the Ukrainian invasion.
It's fair for the
Russian invasion of Ukraine.
Yeah, I think it's fair to say, well, wait a minute, you know, if Ukraine, like, wouldn't Ukrainian support be lower now? And I would say quite possible, but I also say Central and South American support might be lower too.
Yeah, right. That was probably, you know, that window for Ukraine was probably about like August polling for Kamala Harris.
Right.
Probably the, you know.
Yeah.
The high point.
But for those of you who are listening to this, go on this extra discussion going, the point should still hold that the differences are still the differences in the sample, which is, again, point out the complexities of these sorts of attitudes.
Right. So, you know, let's then turn to the election a little more closely and what we were seeing in the polling and the run up to the election. That is, so, you know, we've talked here about, you know, a few aspects of this: party identification, views of Trump, views of immigration and border security, which are, of course, central issues to the Republican campaign. How did all of these factors kind of make manifest in 24? I mean, you know, looking back, it's kind of striking to realize that the polling, we never found a Democratic advantage among Hispanic or Latino voters in the election cycle.
Yep.
Six trial ballot questions between December 2023 and October 2024. Trump led Biden among Hispanics, you know, often within the margin of error, to be fair. And he only trailed Harris in that August poll, which I just inadvertently set up. You know, and that was really only by 1 point. Mm-hmm. And that's really pretty striking.
Yeah.
You know, I mean—
Yeah, I mean, we'll get back to sort of the whys and the hows of this, you know, I think at the end. But, I mean, it is something that, you know, I guess looking back, maybe what's surprising to me is that there were not, and again, we're one poll, there's a lot of polling out there, but I think, you know, our poll's reasonably respected. And more than that, you know, we're consistent, like we're out there regularly.
Yeah.
I'm surprised that we didn't hear more alarm bells in Texas from Democrats.
You know, it's interesting because as I think back, I remember seeing on social media, particularly, and this is, you know, consider the sample, on X/Twitter, you know, that, you know, I noted Republicans pulling that number out.
Yeah.
And conservatives pulling that number out. And I probably, you know, to be very, you know, honest, at the time, I probably said, well, yeah, you know, the thousands of numbers in that poll, that's the one thing people are going to emphasize.
Yeah.
They're not going to, you know, but—
Yeah.
You know, in retrospect, we'll come back to, like, you know, the question of, you know, should we have realized this? But, you know, we'll come back to that. So.
Well, and I'll say, you know, I think in real time, one of the things it was easy to sort of say was, look, you know, Biden is not performing well as a candidate. The economy was not doing well in people's eyes, as told to us in the polling. And I think, you know, it was easy to sort of say, look, you know, do we think that Biden's strength as a candidate is, you know, primarily among Hispanics in Texas? And it's like, well, it's pretty easy to say, well, no, probably not, you know,
right.
I mean, so I think it was relatively easy to sort of push that aside. But the thing was, is, you know, the economy remained a major problem and, you know, Biden ended up not being a problem eventually, right? The economy remained a problem throughout the entirety of the campaign, and the economy was a huge, huge issue. So when we look again at Hispanics, you know, national economic evaluations among Hispanics really mirrored that of the Texas population, and those were largely negative. You know, looking throughout the course of the year, about 50% of Texans and 50% of Hispanics said that they were worse off compared to last year. Asked about the state economy. About 35% said they were worse off. That's not because a bunch of people said they were better off. Most of them because they were saying it was the same, and they've been saying it was worse for a while. So that basically means not great. People, you know, we asked people about their personal economic situations. About 40% said they were worse off. Again, and this was true for the sample as a whole. It was true for Hispanics.
And that personal economic situation, Reed, as always, is kind of the most
useful, I think.
It's the most useful because it's, you know, the macro evaluations – and I could be wrong, but I don't think this is wrong, you know, tend to show more obvious sensitivity to party identification, right, vis-a-vis whoever's in the White House,
right,
or in the governor's mansion for that, right, matter. But especially in the White House on the national note.
Yeah, and I think, you know, and I think the thing that we just kind of kept going back to again and again, and I think this was really the thing in a lot of ways, was, you know, 69% of Texans said that they were very concerned about the price of food and consumer goods in the October polling. That was true of 73% of Hispanics. And when you look at across the board, again, not significantly higher, but it's basically three quarters.
Right.
And when you look across the board, you know, it was 71% of Hispanic males, 71% of, you know, Hispanics making over 60,000, 72% of Hispanics, right, with making under 60,000, over 45, under 45. Ultimately, you know, the things that you would expect to make those attitudes more salient, conservatism, 79% said they were very concerned about the price of food and consumer goods, Republican Hispanics more likely. But overall, it was part of what's, I mean, I think the key here is there weren't a lot of differences by the groups here.
Right.
Because this was a big issue. It was a big issue for everybody. It was a big issue for Hispanic voters of all stripes. And that created, you know, obviously a clear disadvantage given Democratic incumbency. Right?
Right. Yeah. And there was just, you know, this does remind me of the conversation that we had with our colleague Darren Shaw after the last time we were all together doing one of these podcasts. About, you know, the power of just the fundamentals as we were going into this election and thinking, you know, trying to figure out where the movement was going to be and, you know, how successful Democratic mobilization versus Republican mobile, you know, all the campaign stuff.
Right.
You know, it's, to me, you look at these, that last set of numbers, I mean, you know, three quarters to, or, you know, to four fifths or more of these various Latino subgroups are all saying, yeah, I'm concerned about prices.
Yeah.
You know, it's pretty.
I'm doing worse. I'm really concerned about the economy, and if not concerned about the economy, I'm probably concerned about the border. And I'm really concerned about prices. Well, you know, guys, like that kind of.
It tells, you know, and we are very negatively disposed toward the incumbent and the incumbent party,
and especially on those issues.
On those, yeah, exactly. So. All right, so let's what are the questions that come out of this, or how does this illuminate, you know, some of what we've been talking about, and, you know, we set out kind of wanting to kind of think about and gathering all this.
Right.
So, you know, generally, you know, the long-term development of these shifts is evident in the data, but it has been incremental and it has fluctuated.
Yeah.
Right, so.
We already kind of talked about this a little bit, right? And part of that has to do with data access, you know, and the fact is if you're doing one poll, like in Texas, every other year, you know, do you want to go out, you know, on the mats saying like, oh my God, you know, Hispanic Party ID has shifted dramatically since last year? Well, no, because you're not really sure, right? And also you're basing it on, in most cases, small subsamples. And this is where, you know, I'll promote what we're doing. This is where it's useful to have, you know, over 65 publicly available polls going back over a decade where we can go, we can average, we can pool responses, we can average, we can look for fluctuation, be a little bit more confident in sort of talking about some of this stuff. Most people can't do that. Now, the other thing I should say, though, is that some of this fluctuation is just real. I think, I mean, we sort of talked about potential weakness of partisan attachment, but also you just mentioned at the end here the power of macros. And if we think about the macros, you know, Trump's first term, we think about the pandemic, we think about inflation, we think about Biden's aging, we think about assassination attempts, and on and on. And it's like, you know, if you're not moored heavily by partisanship as a way to sort of, you know, engage the political universe right now, it would not be unusual for you to maybe be moved around a bit, you know?
Yeah.
And I think that's certainly something that's sort of floating around out there that I think other people will probably, you know, look into, or if they haven't already, is sort of the fluctuation. I mean, we can go back and look at our data.
Right.
It'd be interesting to see how much fluctuation we saw throughout the election cycle compared to other groups. But yeah, I mean, so I think it's both things. Some of it's methodological, but some of it, of course, is just time,
right,
the times we live in.
Yeah. I mean, I think there were a lot of reasons, and we'll, you know, probably come back to this at the end, but there were a lot of reasons to look at those numbers and say, particularly as we looked at them from poll to poll in an incremental kind of way and think, well, that's interesting. We need to keep watching that.
Yeah. Yeah, that's kind of what we settled. Yeah.
You know, which I think is fair enough, even if it does feel a little like saving the appearances. But we'll engage that directly.
Yeah.
So the other, you know, big point that comes out of here, I think, that is, you know, that we've talked about also, but I think is worth thinking, you know, reiterating as a takeaway, is that you know, part of the story, even though we talk a lot about the, you know, the affirmative part of the story, which is increases in Republican success, is to reiterate that a big part of this is also Democratic attrition,
right,
and the fundamental weakness of, you know, this is points to a weakness of Democratic Party identification among Hispanics.
Yeah, and I think in general, I would also say, you know, a weakness to the overall Democratic turnout operations in the urban and suburban areas, both in Texas and in other places. But in Texas, when you're talking about that, you're talking about, you know, if you're talking about Democrats mobilizing voters in urban and suburban areas, you are generally talking about mobilizing female and non-white voters. And if you're not doing that, you're not doing
right.
it.
And a point that I can't remember if we made it in the podcast or not. I've been using it a lot with press and in, you know, the sort of post-election talks. I mean, you know, the Democratic vote share at the presidential election amidst, you know, an overall decline in turnout in the state, which, you know, is a percentage of the eligible or a percentage of registered vote. But I mean, you know, Harris got more than 400,000 fewer votes than Biden did in 2020.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean,
while Republicans got another 400,000 plus increase, and it wasn't like all those people just switched over.
Yeah. Well, and I think, you know, it was sort of like in the lead up to this election, you know, and especially when early voting started, one of the things that I had to kind of a refrain I had to keep, you know, going to with various people was, look, you know, 2020 was a pretty wild election. It's maybe not the best to make comparison points to for turnout. Well, maybe it wasn't a great election to make comparisons to for a lot of things because, you know, we were in the middle of a global pandemic.
Right,
and maybe that was a strange election.
Go ahead. We've made this point in here, but it's also worth, you know, reiterating yet again in this context. You know, we haven't had what I would think of as a reasonably on-trend normal election, quote-unquote, in a very long time.
Yeah.
Because if you look at 2016, the first Trump election, big surge in turnout.
Mm-hmm.
You know, interesting dynamic, obviously, the entrance of Trump.
Right.
2018, again, very unusually high midterm turnout. You know, it's almost as if the system and the electorate are kind of processing Trump's intervention.
Yeah.
2020, which you just talked about.
Yeah.
2022, a little, you know, maybe a little more standard looking in terms of turnout and what the patterns look like. But for the most part, you know, as we try to say, like, you know, we're kind of without a baseline
mind. It's funny. And I mean, in some ways, I was thinking to myself, you know, and you go back further to the election and reelection of the first black president, the Tea Party wave.
Yeah.
I mean, actually, you know,
we will look back at the first, you know, at the tens,
and before that, a Texas native son came.
Right, right. Yeah, that, exactly.
So it's almost like what is normal is actually a fair question to ask.
Yeah, it's been tough to establish any kind of baseline here. Yeah, I think the Bush point is a good one, really, since 2000.
Right. So, I mean, you were making the point here just about say that, you know, we might think of this in some ways about Democratic attrition, you know, when you're talking about that sort of part of this big story. We do want to go to the other side, though, and also say, like, look, you know, Republican efforts have been effective, but it's interesting that at least so far, this first look, they've been most effective with Hispanics and traditionally Republican groups, right? Republican identifiers, of course, conservatives, but men. And it seems like, you know, maybe Hispanics with a higher socioeconomic status and rural Hispanics. And so, yeah, it looks kind of like a traditional Republican coalition in some ways. And this is something I would say that we've kind of been saying in here like repeatedly, and I've been saying, you know, almost ad nauseum as far as I'm concerned, is this notion of, you know, is Hispanic, and this is sort of a question we'll leave this point with, but, you know, is Hispanic identity in this case really secondary to the reasons that, you know, Republicans are making inroads
yeah.
with this group? And I think there's a lot of reasons to think that's the case.
Yeah.
Okay. You know, I'm going to ask you this question, actually, if that's okay.
Okay,
you know,
sure.
I'm thinking, yeah, so thinking about the 2024 results, you know, overall, you know, I'm trying to think about how do we want to sort out, you know, and we're talking about Texas here, the relative impact of, you know, macro level factors like the economy, Democratic incumbency, we've talked about that, sort of these midterm factors like Republican organizing, you know, and really kind of apparent Democratic dysfunction in terms of, you know, sort of their long-term strategies. And we've talked about that in here, but I mean, Republicans have been active and engaged in trying to, you know, improve their shares among Latino voters, whether or not they're directly targeting them as Latinos. And then short term, you know, the factors like the messaging in this campaign, you know, the singularity of Trump and his appeal. Like, how do we, I mean, first just say, we're, you know, this is the political scientist. And we're like, okay, well, these are all, these are the things. I probably left some stuff out, but these are the factors we're trying to kind of sort out, right?
Yeah. I mean, I think, and I kind of showed my hand on this earlier. I mean, you know, I will, you know, there's an Occam's razor piece to this.
Yeah.
Which is, you know, we could really make this super complicated.
Right.
But, you know, as again, as our colleague Darren was kind of saying going into the election, you know, when you look at the first things you mentioned, if you looked at the macro factors like the economy and the views of the incumbents, you know, it's probably going to explain a lot of the variance overall. Right. And I'm finding that attractive in retrospect, and maybe that's just because it's easy, you know?
Yeah.
But I mean, I think you can't really, you know, I mean, all the talk that, you know, and the problem is there's a level of analysis issue here, right? Which is, I think that explains a lot of what's going on, what happened nationally.
I agree.
I mean, I just think,
yeah,
you know, but I think when you start getting down to a more, you know, closer to home, to a more mid-level analysis, like what's going on in Texas and then what's going on among Texas Hispanics. I've also shown my hand here. I mean, I think we're just in a stage. This is yet another manifestation of, you know, the deep mismatch in the resources between Republicans and Democrats and allied forces in the state. I mean, I just don't, you know, I don't think you can discount the degree, you know, and how successful it was and how much is just, you know, the bleed through of the macroeconomics, fair question. But, you know, as you're often saying, look, you've got Republicans making a real effort here and acting on an insight that we have talked about in here, really going back to 2018 at least, which is, you know, the assumption that because there are a lot of non-voters, that mobilizing those non-voters automatically benefits Democrats. You know, if anybody still believes that, you know, they shouldn't.
Yeah.
Particularly after this election.
But I do think that that point in and of itself really does speak to some of the short-term factors, like the messaging in this campaign. And I think,
you know,
some really, you know, smart efforts, I think, on the Trump campaign's part. And I think, you know, I don't know if I'll call it missteps, but maybe miscalculations on the part of Democrats, right?
Yeah.
I mean, ultimately, you know, when you see, you know, the Democratic, you know, candidate chasing the Republican candidate on populist economic appeals, like, you know, making tips tax free, as opposed to actually having, you know, their own set of sort of clearly, you know, populist or, you know, targeted economic proposals. You know, it's probably, I've said this to other people and I like the way it sounds, so I'm just going to say it here because I want to have it recorded on the podcast too. This is like, you know, the Democratic, the big Harris response was the $25,000 first time home buyer tax credit. And if you think about most places in America, you know, if you're talking about like a $250,000 house is not really affordable or is not available even in most major urban areas, even in secondary urban areas. So basically what you're saying to, like, you know, is your economic policy proposal is, hey, if you've got $5,000 to $15,000, maybe you could get 10% on a $400,000 house. Hey, by the way, interest rates are going to be about 8% to 12% for you.
Well,
and so
and,
it's
know,
sort of,
I mean,
like, I mean, you're just not, I mean, you're just not talking to, I think, people in a realistic way.
Well, and I
way.
Think tactically, you know, and again, this kind of pops us back up to the national level, but, you know, tactically, I think they came out of the box with a tactic that they were trying to speak, speaking of, about, you know, we're going to fight price gouging. And it was not, it was ill-conceived and not that well presented, and it was thin.
Yeah.
As soon as somebody scratched it, well, really, how are you really going to do that? You know, and then you're off, you know, supermarket consolidation, antitrust, you know.
Right.
It was a loser.
Yeah. I think it definitely was.
So
I think that's part, I mean, that's also part, I mean, I think, you know, the mixture of, I mean, so I agree with you. I mean, just to have my take on, I mean, 100%, I'm not going to go that long in this. I think that's right. The macro stuff, the more I watch all this stuff, I mean, we're all kind of buffeted by the winds and stuff. And I think, you know, for Democrats to be competitive here, they need the wind at their back.
But I guess what I would say, I guess, to kind of bring it back down here, I mean, I think what is tricky here and, you know, we're going to have to do some more work on and think about more is, you know, how that filters down. I mean, because what I would say is, you know, that macro level kind of hurt the Democrats nationally. Now, look, popular vote-wise, once everything's counted in California, the popular vote gap is still going to be, the last I saw, 1.5, maybe 2%.
Yeah.
So I don't want to overstate, you know, the degree of this, but it was a lot bigger than that here in Texas. And I think that is, you know, because, you know, once those, you know, those kind of macro factors got processed down here, the Republican advantage was amplified by the kind of factors that we were talking about at the intermediate level. And the fact that there's not really much of an answer to that. And, you know, it may be, and we haven't talked about this very much, that, you know, part of the evidence for that arguably could be that, you know, Allred did not lose by as much as Harris did in Texas, you know, which suggests that, you know, the kind of adjustments that they were trying to make to run to the center, you know, to try to approach some of these issues in a different way, to be more centrist. I mean, you know, the national campaign was doing this too, but to be more centrist on immigration and the border, not outrightly more of what we would have thought of conservative
oil
on
and
it.
Gas.
Yeah. You know, the oil and gas factor, you know, speaking to economic issues or trying to. They didn't have much space to do that, but they tried. You know, I think does speak to that, and it speaks to the, you know, I mean, it's yet another sort of manifestation, and we'll be talking about this a lot probably as the session starts, of, you know, where the, you know, where the quote-unquote national, you know, increasing nationalization of politics meets the bottom-up state level stuff.
Yeah, I mean, that is,
you know,
real...
and how those two, you know, I talked about the filtering down. Well, what filters down, but, you know, what gets filtered out?
Yeah.
Right.
I mean, you know, when you bring that up, and I mean, what I sort of think is, you know, mixing together what's kind of interesting is sort of the Republican resource advantage with the nationalization piece of it. And to the extent that, you know, the nationalization of politics, and I think I'm going to say this, and I think I believe it, probably hurts Democrats pretty.
Yeah,
significantly here in Texas, but it hurts them so significantly because of that resource gap multiplier. You know, I mean, whatever's going on anywhere in the country, whether it's San Francisco or Detroit or New York City, you know, the messaging that gets filtered down, you know, is filtered by Republican voices and, you know, and their allies and interest group universe, which has a lot of money to spend, a lot of resources, and can characterize Democrats writ large based on oftentimes their worst ideas. You know, in a way, the Democrats don't really have the same, you know, they don't, there's no symmetry there.
Yeah, no, there's a fundamental asymmetry here, and it's just, you know, so you took a disadvantage, and, you know, what it means is that Republican candidates were really able to leverage that here in a way that Democrats just didn't have, you know, go through it all the time, you know. They don't have the organizational means. They don't have the resources. I mean, you know, you could say, well, Allred had a lot of resources, but not to the point where he had an advantage in any significant way.
No, and I think the point here is that by being a congressman, and actually you kind of see this in the O'Rourke campaigns too, you actually have a significant disadvantage because as a Democrat, you get naturally drawn into whatever the national dynamic is. Then you have to come back and play in Texas, and it just doesn't play that well.
Yeah. I mean, I think the big... you know, lingering question in all of this, you know, in terms of the way that you set this up as a question is, you know, is the question that's been with us for a long time now, which is, you know, how do you quite understand Trump's role in all this? And look, some of this is, you know, is relatively obvious. I mean, in the sense, you know, I think, you know, by now, I mean, if we haven't figured this out, then, you know, shame on us, right? In the sense that, you know, I really do think that the, you know, Trump's lack of, I'm going to put an adjective on this, conventional ideological commitments.
Yeah.
I think obviously helps him, helps, and at this moment, in the macro environment helped Republicans. But it also makes me you know, and this seems, you know, skeptical about whether we're seeing this as an inflection point or not. And there's no way to know now, because who knows what kind of long-term effects Trump's going to have on the party, what happens, you know,
well,
wither MAGA ideology or MAGA populism. But, you know, and you know, it goes back to the thing when we had Darren in here, and I didn't really articulate it very well in that podcast, I don't think, because because I'm still thinking about it. But I think that is one of the things that I was really, why I was really struck by the ideological assessments of the candidates, you know, in which we found that, you know, there's not this consensus that Donald Trump is extremely conservative.
Right.
Even among Republicans.
Yep.
Right. And I think that, you know, the key is in that. And I, you know, I think I sent you that piece in the Atlantic about the Freudian analysis of the, you know, voters' response to Trump and what it is that attracts people to Trump. But, you know, the Freudian analysis, I think, you know, probably not the best way to go in 2024, but it does get at something that we have kind of said in here and that other people have said, but that I think we're still grappling with. And I think it really especially flummoxes Democrats and progressive liberals, that there's something kind of inchoate and id-driven, to go back to the Freudian thing for just a beat, about Trump's attraction, particularly to low propensity voters.
Yeah.
Right. I mean, there is something that people are responding to in Trump that is not easily spatially modeled, put it that way.
Yeah.
You know, right? In ideological space. It's about, and it's not the, even the, you know, we've been done all these trait questions about Trump, but it's hard to ask somebody about a trait that they might not be responding to entirely consciously.
Well, that's what I was thinking, you know.
Or in political terms.
You know, I can't believe I'm doing this, but, you know, I think it makes me think of my dissertation work, which is crazy. But, you know, one of the things that I studied was anger. And one of the interesting, I did all these experiments, you know, if you make people angry, essentially, which is funny to do. So you make all these people angry, and then you kind of try to figure out what impact it has on various aspects of their political judgments. And basically, you know, almost nothing. That's how this works.
Research.
But then, you know, the one area where you could find a consistent impact in terms of anger was that people really responded to candidates who also acted angry. You know, and I thought that was always kind of interesting. The sort of, you know, there's a whole like literature about mirroring emotions and that kind of stuff. That's very interesting. I mean, it's actually fascinating stuff. I mean, that's why I ended up writing a dissertation on some of this stuff. But anyway, the main point being is that was interesting. That was the one thing I found. It was people didn't care about policy. It wasn't. I mean, there's a lot of theoretical reasons to believe that people would get more extreme in their policy preferences. All these kinds of, you know, reasonable hypotheses. And honestly, none of that happened. But the thing that they did was they liked someone who was angry, who expressed it, who expressed what they were feeling at that point in time. And I think, you know, your discussion about sort of low propensity voters, I mean, we can't really sit here and think that, like, well, you know, it's their attitudes on tariffs, you know, or like, you know, well,
he tapped into the long dormant love of tariffs.
America. Or like, you know, it's like, you know, net neutrality view. I mean, you know, so it's like, so the idea that someone is, you know, expressing frustration with the system, frustration with, you know, when I say the system, not just the political system, but the economic system, you know, kind of writ large, and sort of saying, you know, I can tell you what the problems are and they sound plausible to you, and it's being expressed in a tone that you feel, you know, I'm not going to say that's working for everybody, but, you know, it's going to work for some people probably.
Well, yeah. And I think, you know, I mean, and it's funny you would raise that. And I think the anger, you know, there's been a lot of, you know, attention to the, you know, angry Trump. You know, the angry Trump appeal at a time of low levels of trust and affection for institutions. Mm-hmm. And we've tested trust, not affection. I just threw that in there. But I think that is kind of part of it, too. Allegiance, right? There's a legitimacy issue here, probably. But the other thing I was thinking about that also that we just haven't quite figured out. I mean, and I think, you know, there's more people have figured it out a little bit more, because embedded in the emotional appeal.
Yeah.
Is also, and it's they're tangled up, I think, is also a piece that is just the entertainment factor.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, I think, you know, and we're seeing, you know, and you know, we should think about how we might test this, but
yeah.
You know, I think I've, you know, I've used the shtick with a few people, and I know I've done it with you, but I mean, look, I think it's one thing, it's interesting to me that in the final weeks of the campaign, particularly the final couple weeks, there was a lot of talk from kind of, you know, more or less mainstream media,
traditional sources,
you know, and commentator that, you know, Trump is just, he's acting weird. He's doing all this weird shit.
Yeah, he's turning up when the campaign's trying to be professional.
And yeah, and he's, you know, I mean, like, you know, he's, you know, what is this spending, however long it was, just DJing the rally and doing the Trump dance?
Yeah.
And the next thing, you know, a few weeks later, you know, the Trump dance is showing up on TikTok.
Yeah, I'm a big U.S. soccer fan. Christian Pulisic, anybody? Yeah,
yeah, right. And like, you know, and I just think, and again, it's kind of like, you know, to go back to what we said, it's kind of like the Latino numbers. I mean, this has been hiding in plain sight the whole time.
Right.
Yeah. Right. In the sense that, yeah, remember, I mean, he wasn't, when he ascended to the presidency, it wasn't because he was, even though that's not the campaign messaging, the heart of that was not Donald Trump's art of the deal, successful businessman, although they tried to pour that in. It was because he had been on TV.
Yeah. Everybody knew who he was.
And he was an entertainer.
Yeah.
And he took to that.
Mm-hmm.
And I just think, you know, and yes, I don't want to discount, you know, the policy, the cultural stuff, the, you know, the even the anger factor.
Yeah, and we definitely won't and haven't. But
yeah,
like,
and the, you know, and we've written about this a bit. You know, the you know, the tapping into nativism. You know, the kind of I mean, there are ideological elements.
But this is a super important distinction because we've said this a bunch of times. But this is another angle on this, which is to say, you know, this is another piece of the fact that, you know, Trump tapped into a lot of attitudes that already existed.
Right.
And the fact is, and I think that's important here to say, you know, is an entertainer and is someone who, again, it brings something very different than what people are used to, you know, into the political space, you know, and he is doing it while at the same time tapping into these attitudes that already exist. I think a lot of people miss this sometimes and think that, like, he's creating these attitudes or he's changing, you know, the tone.
Right.
And it's like, no, I mean, this was already there, which allows him the space to kind of operate, you know.
Yeah,
I think.
Yeah, and operate in a way that is, you know, is fairly novel.
Extremely novel. I mean, I think, you know, I mean,
right.
I mean, that's the thing. I mean, I think what a lot of Democrats were lamenting at the end of the campaign that, you know, he could stand on a stage and dance for 45 minutes. Like, imagine if Harris had done that.
Right.
And it's true. I mean, that's the thing. Like, you know, whether you're, you know, you can be partisan, you cannot be partisan, whatever. Like, it's true. She could not have done that.
Right.
You know, and it would not be a meme right now. And there you go.
Yeah. And he, and so, you know, to go back, you know, to where we started, I mean, and so, you know, in terms of thinking about, to me, that is the big, well, that is one of the big sticking points that even though it feels like I might be sticking too much to something that the, you know, all the evidence that we've talked about for the last 45 minutes points in the other direction, but I'm not quite ready to say this shift is, you know, is permanent.
Yeah.
Because, you know, I mean, I think, you know, per some of the other things we've been saying, you know, there's nothing preventing a big share of Latino voters, particularly in some of, you know, some of these subgroups, particularly I think young voters, from responding to Trump in the same way that most other people that have decided to vote for him have responded to him. And once he's gone, you know, how much, you know, how transformational is he? I mean, you know, can the next candidate also?
Well, you know, and I think, and this, you know, and I think the flip side of this is to say, you know, Democrat, you know, as you said, I mean, what I'm latching onto there is to say, is, you know, why shouldn't we expect sort of like young Latinos or young Latino men to respond the way other young men have responded or other young Latinos or other groups, you know, have responded to Trump? And I think that's right. And I think it also then on the flip side, it speaks to the fact that, you know, the way that Democrats have thought about identity is clearly, you know, ossified to a point of becoming, if anything, maybe potentially detrimental.
Yeah.
Right. You know, and I think, you know, people point out a lot, you know, sort of the Latinx imbroglio, you know, it's kind of a prime recent example of where you sort of say, hey, what, you know, what are Democrats doing? Because Donald Trump is not necessarily speaking to people. It's not speaking to Hispanic voters by engaging their Hispanic identity. Right. And so the question, you know, Democrats have to ask themselves is, you know, is this the path that they think is going to be successful for them? Is this really what is going to work? Because it doesn't seem to be working. And if anything, I mean, I think the data, you know, on a lot of stuff, you know, the increase in sort of multiracial identification, you know, even just the way that I think, you know, young people look at some of these other sort of social issues, I think race and ethnicity is actually seeming to become less central as it was in prior generations. And I think there's a lot of discussion about the fact that, you know, a lot of Democratic thing, we talked about this before, is based around the notion of the Black experience in America, but the Black experience in America is changing rapidly as well.
Right.
And so the idea that, you know, Hispanics are a carbon copy of sort of the Black experience, one, is totally wrong and has been wrong, you know, forever.
Right.
But also to the extent that that's even, you know, sort of, I think, the strategic game plan or the way I think of it, it's like, I think, you know, that's like, okay, let's take a pause. We just went over data for 45 minutes as why you need to just stop thinking that way.
Yeah.
And I think Texas is actually, I mean, this is kind of what's great. I mean, it's why I love being here. You know, this is like ground zero for a lot of this stuff because we have so many Hispanics. They are distributed across the state in very different situations. I mean, one last plug I want to make is, you know, hey, Stark County, great. Awesome, guys. There's a lot of Hispanics in Stark County. I'm talking to you, national media. But you know what? Also, very low rate of college degree attainment, much lower than Hispanics overall in the state. Very low, you know, average income, significantly lower than Hispanics overall in the state. So when you're trying to describe what's going on in Texas here, you got to understand that this, you know, what goes on in the Rio Grande Valley and Stark County. And so it doesn't really explain the whole story. And I hope at least with this podcast,
well, the,
uncovers
yeah.
some of this.
Yeah. You
nuance.
Know, should the binding agent of those stories be ethnicity?
Yeah. Or,
right? or
yeah.
not. Right.
Yeah. Or, you know, ethnicity, let's say, should it be ethnicity and should it be an arbitrary county boundary?
Yeah. You know? Right. I mean, it's convenient that there are counties for data, but that's all it is.
I love it, but it's
yeah.
But we need to be realistic here.
Okay. So let's wind this up, but I do want to, let's go back. Yeah. I want to go back to, you know, one thing in particular, which is a little, so, you know, how are you feeling this morning about, I think I know, but I, you know, about the, you know, should we quote unquote have seen this coming more clearly?
Yeah. You know,
were we too resistant to,
you know, I think we were cautious, and I think, you know, I think, you know, there's a speaker colleague Darren Shaw, you know, I like to be skeptical but not cynical. And I think, you know, all the things that we were saying still hold about, you know, sample sizes, about variability. I think, you know, when I look back, I feel pretty okay not, you know, having jumped up and down every time the Hispanic share of the subsample got a little bit more Republican within the margin of error from one poll to the next. I mean, I don't think it's our job to jump on those things. And if anything, the election became the confirmatory piece that that trend had been ongoing and was accurate. You know, at the same time, I think the macro factors were just so big. I mean, I don't feel as though like I was sitting here not believing the data. I think I was actually believing the data, which is to say, you know, and I think about, you know, the conversations we have when we're like pouring through the data. And I think, you know, I'm sure at some point I probably said something to the effect of, you know, if you express that the sample, you know, the Hispanic sample looked more Republican than usual, or is looking a little bit, you know, more favorable towards Trump or a little bit more conservative or whatever, you know, I'm pretty sure that my response was or would have been, yeah, but look at what they're concerned about and look at what their attitudes are. Which is, you know, the economy, immigration, what we, you know, what their, you know, job approval numbers or, you know, really high disapproval numbers were towards Biden, Biden's performance as a candidate, and then really flaming out. I mean, there are a lot of reasons in there, and the question wasn't so much maybe like whether it was real because we kept seeing it, but whether it would bounce back. I mean, there's this idea, right. I think, in the political science where you think, you know, what's the point of campaigns? One of the major point of campaigns is we think of it as partisan activation. They go out, they remind Democrats whether they're Democrats, remind Republicans whether Republicans, hit them with the messaging, and then all of a sudden people who weren't paying attention kind of fall into their normal patterns. Didn't happen, right? But we didn't know that it wasn't going to happen until it didn't happen. And then you add it to this other stuff, you say, oh, okay. I would say I feel okay about it also because to the extent that there was a, you know, sort of this kind of idea, you know, going around in Democratic circles near the end that there was like all this kind of like secret stuff going on, just to put it in a big bucket, you know, my answer to all that in text messages to people and whatever was like, yeah, but like people say the economy is the issue they care about and they don't like the economy. So I just don't see, I just like, so if, you know, Harris were to have pulled up some sort of an upset in Texas, nationally, whatever, that would have been really interesting. That would have been really hard to come up with the story as to what happened. This isn't a hard story.
Yeah.
So that's right.
I mean, I guess my feeling about it is I'm trying to, as I think about it and think back to my response.
It's also not our job to make predictions, but that's a whole other
thing. Well, right. And look, I mean, and that's utterly fair and something we'll continue to say over and over again, probably.
Till we die.
To no effect.
Till I die.
But, you know, we'll keep doing it anyway. That's the, you know, the hill we'll die on. You know, I've thought about this a bit. And, you know, my recollection is sort of being worried that intellectually all the things you were saying I could parse at the time and made sense. But there's, I think I was mindful of the historical difficulty that we and everyone have had in surveying Latino respondents.
Yeah.
And it's particularly hard in Texas given rurality and, you know, for all the obvious kinds of reasons.
It's probably getting more difficult in some ways.
Right. And it's, and I think it probably, you know, I could say, you know, more immediately, you know, it made me, I was very cautious about the numbers and just, you know, the polling process. And we spent a lot of time answering questions about the difficulties of polling. And, you know, I mean, I think I really kind of internalized that in this and said, you know, this could, you know, there could just, you know, there could be a bug here somewhere.
There could be a bias in the
yeah, that we don't, sample. That we're not, that we haven't figured out. You know, and I was kind of, you know, I mean, I think I sort of internalized a certain skepticism about it. Even though, you know, I could build the narrative, but I mean, I can build narratives for a lot of things. You know, I mean,
you don't say.
So, you know, fair enough. So, I mean, that's kind of how I'm, you know, I mean, from the standpoint of like, you know, what we're doing when we're doing this part of the stuff, you know, when we're polling and what we're doing.
Yeah.
Right. You know, something you said a minute ago is like, well, you know, I guess I feel validated, you know, I'm a little relieved almost, right?
Yeah.
In that narrow sense that, okay, like I didn't have to be so worried, right?
Right.
In a way, you know, because I, you know, obviously, you know, part of the job is thinking about our public facing, you know, the legitimacy of the whole thing and all of that.
As one should if they care about
it. Yeah. I mean, as I was looking back when you compiled all this data, I mean, I'm just doing my job, I guess. But, you know, I did think it's like, I guess, you know, I guess I did have a crisis of faith, right? At some level. Now, I can package that and it's fair, you know, crisis of faith is being overly dramatic, but. You know, I think you're right. We were cautious. But as I think back on it, now I look at how it's all turned out, you know, my cautious probably did make me a little too intellectually conservative in what I made of those numbers and the effort I took to probably look back.
Yeah.
Like, you know, I mean, now you look at all this, you kind of go, well, you know, you know, it was coming.
Right.
But, you know, I mean, you know, when we got, the when we looked at the Latino breakdowns in the in the October poll, and it was, you know, as it turns out, about what the exit polls told us, right? As I recall, I was just kind of like, you know,
okay, no, I mean, it was wild, so,
so, you know, I mean, I, you know, my answer to that, should we have seen this coming more clearly? You know, a fair answer would be. Maybe if we approach this, or if I should speak for myself, if I approach this a little bit different, a little bit differently, probably could have made more of this going into it.
Yeah.
You know, but I also think erring on the side of caution is part of what we're supposed to do, I think, as part of the public-facing mission of what we do here.
Yeah, I think another lesson for me that comes out of this just generally, and it's something that I find that whenever I'm giving any sort of presentation basically on public opinion of any topic, I find myself increasingly sort of saying, you know, we're still recovering from COVID.
Yeah.
Right? Because when you look at the trend lines about everything, there's this huge, you know, essentially discontinuity in the data, and it happens during COVID. And then you can kind of look back if you have a long enough time series, which we happen to, and you can say, are we back to, you know, quote unquote normal or not? And in most cases, we're not.
You know, on that, we talked a little bit about Latinos and the framing of political tendencies and identities. And I was glad you mentioned the, you know, how much, you know, conceptual stickiness does the idea of a Latino political identity have right now?
Oof.
And that's been a long, you know, that's been a question. You and I have talked about this offline in a lot of different circumstances. I mean, you know, showing my age, and I've kind of raised this a little bit in the podcast before. I mean, this is a, you know, if you look back at the breadth of the academic and the related political discussion of Latinos as a group in the United States, you know, this latest turn, if you will, in what we're seeing and some of the stuff that we've talked about, particularly the political identification trends. And those, you know, I was glad you pulled those discrimination numbers because that really also underlines this, you know, really underlines both the interesting history of thinking about Hispanics as a coherent and institutionalized, you know, quote unquote minority group, and the politics around it as well. And that's a whole other, that's a discussion for another podcast, et cetera. But I mean, you know, there was a point when as Hispanic identity was created for the 1980 census in the aftermath of the kind of post-civil riot or civil rights identity politics and how that manifested itself among Latinos, you know, there were, you know, very conscious tactical and strategic decisions at various times to emphasize, construct, deploy this identity in very direct political ways. And a lot of that now seems to be kind of decomposing, if you will, in a way that, you know, and there have been discussions of this, you know, in, you know, ethnic studies and, you know, more sociological than political, I think, or even, you know, in sort of theoretical foundations of identity politics, blah, blah, blah. But this is a very interesting turn in that discussion. And I can't help but think about, you know, some of the senior people in Latino politics that were around when I was in graduate school in the late 80s as there evolved a real debate around just how fixed the idea of a Latino political identity was and how for a lot of people during that discussion, if you were to stand up and say, you know, maybe we should rethink, you know, we should revisit the idea of assimilation.
Right.
You know, that we've applied to earlier kind of models of more European immigrants or, you know, maybe, you know, this isn't, you know, this idea to build a pan-ethnic identity, you know, is kind of forcing the issue. That was a very unpopular position to take. You know, and I was in, you know, more than one room where people got in pretty heated, borderline personal discussion, you know, disagreements about that.
You know, it's funny. I mean, you're describing that and I wonder, you know, are those the sorts of discussions that are taking place right now in terms of campaigns?
Yeah.
You know, those heated, uncomfortable discussions about how this should be handled.
Yeah, and, right. And so I think,
at least on the Democratic side, I should say.
Well, but, you know, but even, it's probably more heated on the Democratic side because of the, you know, the established constituencies.
What's the point? Those constraints, those same constraints probably apply, right? You know, and there are people with very strong views about some of those issues.
Right. I mean, I think it's easier from a conservative ideological position to sort of dismiss the idea of a shared collective political identity in a way that, you know.
Well,
I think you're just less likely to get a lot of pushback probably, you know?
Yeah. But, I mean, this is a whole,
and that's an open question.
This is a huge discussion. I mean, what I've been thinking about a lot is how, you know, sort of the language, you know, sort of the race neutrality language, which itself is generally pretty racist when you actually kind of apply it, is actually becoming in some ways much more normal. You know,
well,
in the political space in a way that, you know, in some ways when you say, well, like who's playing identity politics, who's, you know, sort of playing with race. And I mean, strangely, you know, I think, you know, Democrats are a lot more, they're much more open to criticisms now than they
were.
Yeah,
I think, and we're seeing that, and that, you know, that intersects with another very uncomfortable discussion going on in the Democratic side about, you know, quote unquote, I'm doing air quotes.
Yeah, a lot of air quotes.
You know, catering to groups.
Right.
Right.
Yeah.
And so I think all of this really, you know, reopens that discussion in a kind of interesting way. That obviously is having immediate political fallout.
Yeah. No, I mean, it's going to be interesting to kind of go back. I mean, there's a lot of things, you know, I think that we've talked about today that really sort of point to sort of future research questions, you know, more polling, more stuff. But honestly, a lot of it is actually the most interesting stuff in there is actually very difficult to untangle and disentangle.
Yeah, no, I think that's right. So with that, thanks, Josh, for all the work you did compiling our data here. Very illuminating.
Great
and super
time.
Helpful.
I enjoyed it. So.
Yeah, I could tell you did, which is, I like.
Yeah.
That's good.
No, I like it too.
Thanks again to our excellent production team here in the Dev Studio in the College of Liberal Arts at UT Austin. Particularly good mic placement today.
Oh,
thank
great
you.
Great mic placement.
Thank you all for listening. We've talked about a ton of data today. We'll post some of it with the podcast post on our website at texaspolitics.utexas.edu. But I would also point out that you can go to our search engine and, you know, this lengthens what should be a quick sign off. But if you go to our search engine, you can pick a policy topic or subject area, and you can then go down to a lower menu and have all the results presented by racial and ethnic group if you want to go and dig around in these patterns in Latino political opinion that we've been talking about today. Pretty easy to use. Hopefully we'll have a new website that will be even easier to use in the near future. But until then, again, thanks for listening, and we'll be back soon with another Second Reading podcast. The Second Reading podcast is a production of the Texas Politics Project at the University of Texas at Austin.